Blog Talk Radio.
It's the NAAEA and the Community Conversation with my man, Brother George. Another segment to get you to thinking about our history, our culture, our community, and our city. Come on. There is no better love than love for self and kind. This is the NAAEA Community Conversations, Part 9, What Slavery Did to Us, the Civil Rights Era, a conversation with Brother George about our history. Today we will discuss the impact of Willie Lynch Brown versus the Board of Education, Thurgood Marshall, the significance of James Baldwin, and much, much more. But let's start with the NAAEA. NAAEA is an organization, the African American, the National African American Empowerment Association, that is designed to ensure that the needs of our community are met. How? Through the development of programs and services that educate, inspire, motivate, and empower our community to be the best that we can be. And it is shows like this and services like that, this that continue to have us to improve ourselves by knowledge of self. Knowledge is power, people. So continue to listen to the show. And I'd like to welcome in my good friend and Brother George. Brother George, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am, brother. And thank you for inviting me another time, and I appreciate it every time that we do it.
All right, well, let's get started with our favorite segment, and that is the impact of Willie Lynch.
Well, one of the impacts of Willie Lynch was color consciousness, and I have a piece from Dr. Naeem Akbar's book called Chains and Images of Psychological Slavery. In concluding this discussion on the psychological effects of slavery, we would like to address another destructive characteristic from this experience. This slavery effect is a color consciousness which is older than slavery, but found its real roots for the African American during slavery. Color consciousness is the unnatural assignment of mental or moral traits based upon physical skin color. These traits can be either positive or negative, as long as they are based on the assumption of skin color. Of course, the very condition of the African slavery was done on the basis of skin color. The failure of Caucasians and Native Americans to endure the physical abuse of involuntary servitude led to the enslavement of the African, meaning that they just didn't have it in them to be slaves. And so they decided they were going to do that to us. The contradiction that slavery presented for the supposedly Christian nation led to the justification of slavery as a divinely authorized activity. The African's black skin was considered as an evidence for his curse, stated to serve as a slave. Some obscure Bible allegory regarding the curse of Ham was used to justify the inhuman treatment of the African, who was wrongly assumed to be a descendant of Ham. So dark skin became equated with the reason for slavery. The skin color of the slave became associated with other kinds of subhuman traits. On the other hand, the slave master's pale skin became equated with superhuman traits. In fact, God and all the saints and the entire heavenly host became identified with pale skin. The logical conclusion of the abused and oppressed slave was that the basis for his condition was his skin color, and the way out of his condition was to change his color. Now, that's some food for thought with color consciousness.
Thank you, Brother George. The black dark skin has a curse. Let's think about that. That's our gift, right? That is the thing that we have that gives us our creativity. It is the thing that gives us the gifts to the world, that the world follows you. It follows us. And never let anyone make you believe for 1 minute that your gift is a curse, because the world follows you. Brother George, let's talk about Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka.
Well, the reason why I chose Brown versus the Board of Education first is because Brown versus the Board of Education pretty much laid the groundwork for the rest of the civil rights movement, and I'll get to that a little further along. Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, was a landmark 1954 Supreme Court case in which the justices ruled unanimously that racial segregation of children in public schools was unconstitutional. Brown versus the Board of Education was one of the cornerstones of the civil rights movement and helped establish the precedent that separate but equal education and other services were not, in fact, equal at all. In the case, in the most famous case, a plaintiff named Oliver Brown filed a class action suit against the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas in 1951, after his daughter, Linda Brown, was denied entrance to Topeka's all-white elementary schools. In his lawsuit, Brown claimed that the schools for black children were not equal to the schools for white children, that segregation violated his so-called Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which holds that no state can deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protections under the law. The case went before the U.S. District Court in Kansas, which agreed that public school segregation had a detrimental effect upon the colored children and contributed to a sense of inferiority, but still upheld the separate but equal doctrine. Now, the Brown versus the Board of Education verdict. When the Brown case four other cases were combined, they became Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka. Thurgood Marshall, the head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, served as the chief attorney for the plaintiffs. 13 years later, President Lyndon Baines Johnson would appoint Marshall as the first Supreme Court justice. At first, the justices were divided on how to rule on the school, and Stan and Chief Justice Fred M. Vinson holding the opinion that Plessy verdict should stand. That's Plessy versus Ferguson's verdict of separate but equal was constitutional. But in September 1953, before Brown versus the Board of Education was to be heard, Vinson died, and President Dwight Eisenhower replaced him with Earl Warren, then governor of California. In the decision issued on May 17, 1954, Warren wrote, "In the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. as segregated schools are inherently unequal. As a result, the court ruled that the plaintiffs were being deprived of the equal protection under the law guaranteed by the 14th Amendment.
Okay. Equal protection under the law, separate, segregated schools. And when you look at inner city schools today and inner city education, I would just say separate. Let's move on, brother. Who was Thurgood Marshall? Tell us about him.
I'm sorry about that. My mic wasn't on, so I'm going to start over.
It's all right, brother. It's
okay.
All right.
Thurgood Marshall, perhaps best known as the first African-American Supreme Court justice, played an instrumental role in promoting racial equality during the Civil Rights Movement. As a practicing attorney, Marshall argued a record-breaking 32 cases before the Supreme Court, winning 29 of them. In fact, Marshall represented and won more cases before the high court than any other person. During his 24-year term as Supreme Court Justice, Marshall's passion, support for individual and civil rights guided his policies and decisions. Most historians regard him as an influential figure in shaping social policies and upholding laws to protect minorities.
Thurgood Marshall, bad man. He's a winner, period. All right, brother, tell us a little bit about the story of the Confederate statues.
Now, once the civil rights began to be a fight amongst black people, whites got really upset about the fact that our people were trying to get the equal rights and equal protections under the law as everyone else in this country. So as a result, while every statue in every town has a different origin, taken together, the roughly 700 Confederate monuments in the United States tell a national story. Many of these commemorations of those on the losing side of the Civil War are not newer than one might think. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which maintains a list that of these monuments, the memorials are spread over 31 states plus the District of Columbia, exceeding the 11 Confederate states that succeeded at the offset of the Civil War. Now, what that's saying is that you got 20 states that was really with the Union that put up these Confederate monuments to mock black people. So eventually they started to build Confederate monuments. The vast majority of them were built between 1890 and 1950. Which matches up exactly with the era of Jim Crow segregation. Once they won the Jim Crow segregation thing in 18, when they won Plessy versus Ferguson and extended Jim Crow, they just, you know, as a mop, they continue to put these statues up. And so according to the Southern Poverty Southern Poverty Law Center, the biggest spike was between 1900 and 1920. In contrast to the earlier memorials that mourn dead soldiers, these monuments tended to glorify leaders of the Confederacy, like General Robert E. Lee, former president of the Confederacy Jefferson Davis, and General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. Now, what's interesting is that white women were instrumental in raising funds to build these Confederate monuments. The United Daughters of the Confederacy, founded in the 1890s, was probably the most important and influential group, Elliott says. In fact, the group was responsible for creating what is basically the Mount Rushmore of the Confederacy, a gigantic stone carving of Davis, Lee, and Jackson in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Its production began in the 1910s and it was completed in 1960s. But the backlash of the civil rights movement was spreading Confederate symbols in other ways. In 1956, Georgia redesigned its state flag to include the Confederate battle flag. And in 1962, South Carolina placed the flag atop its Capitol building. So these Confederate monuments are basically a result of us fighting for our civil rights. And they're trying to take them down now.
You are listening to NAAEA Community Conversations, Part 9, What Slavery Did to Us, the Civil Rights Era. We're talking to Brother George, and he's laying it down. So let's keep it moving. We're going to talk right now about the significance of Brother James Baldwin.
I put James Baldwin right in, kind of in the middle of things, because James Baldwin was an essayist, a playwright, a novelist, and a voice of the American Civil Rights Movement, known for works including Notes of a Native Son, The Fire Next Time, and Go Tell It on the Mountain. James Baldwin was an amazing writer. His writings were very instrumental to our people, changing their position on the way that we were being treated in this country, that we weren't receiving our rights. I mean, he wrote a multitude of books, and he was very passionate about his civil rights. And I seen him, you know, debate William F. Buckley, one of white folks' best debaters, and James Baldwin just destroyed him in that debate. I mean, he just didn't have, and you could see the debate is right on YouTube, and you could look at it for yourself, you know. But James Baldwin was very instrumental with his writings of the 40s and forward to help us in the mindset of the civil rights struggle.
James Baldwin. An amazing, amazing brother. Go out if you haven't seen it and look at the documentary, I'm Not Your Negro. Really powerful piece on James Baldwin. Let's keep it moving. The significance of James Baldwin is followed by the Civil Rights Movement, the 14th and 15th Amendments, followed by Rosa Parks as well.
Well, the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement was a struggle for social justice that took place mainly during the 1950s and 60s for Black Americans to gain equal rights under the law in the United States. The Civil War had officially abolished slavery, but it didn't end discrimination against Black people. They continued to endure the devastating effects of racism, especially in the South. By the mid-20th century, Black Americans had more than enough of prejudice and violence against them. They, along with many white Americans, mobilized and began an unprecedented fight for equality that spanned two decades. Now, the 14th Amendment in 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution gave black people equal protection under the law. And the 15th Amendment granted black Americans the right to vote. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I think they said it was just black males, the right to vote. But still, many white Americans, essentially those in the South, were unhappy that people they once enslaved were now more or less equal on an equal playing field. And, you know, it's been very devastating with the segregationist laws and all of these things that took place. And during the civil rights era, I mean, it took a lot of gallant, you know, heart and determination for our people to work their way through these things. Now, one of the people that will always be attached to the civil rights struggle is Rosa Parks. On December 1st of 1955, a 42-year-old woman named Rosa Parks found a seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus after work. Segregationist laws at the time stated black passengers must sit in the designated seats at the back of the bus, and Parks had complied. When a white man got on the bus and couldn't find a seat in the white section at the front of the bus driver instructed Parks and three other black passengers to give up their seats. Parks refused and was arrested. As word of her arrest ignited outrage and support, Parks unwittingly became the mother of the modern-day civil rights movement. Black community leaders formed the Montgomery Improvement Association, led by Baptist minister Martin Luther King Jr., a role which would place him in front and center of the fight for civil rights. Parks' courageous insight incited the Montgomery Improvement Association to stage a boycott of the Montgomery bus system. The Montgomery bus boycott lasted 381 days. On November of 1956, the Supreme Court ruled segregated seating was unconstitutional. And so they won based on that boycott.
A great win for us all. You're listening to NAAEA Community Conversations, partnering What Slavery Did to Us, the Civil Rights Era Conversation with Brother George, talking about our people and our plan and our history. Join us each Saturday for the NAAEA Empowerment Saturday. Each Saturday at 2 p.m., we have a discussion. It's a hearty discussion. You need to join in and listen to some of the stuff we talk about. Join us each Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern, for Empowerment Saturday. Let's move on now to the Little Rock Nine. Little Rock Nine, what you got, brother?
Now, the Little Rock Nine were the first nine students that they used to integrate in Little Rock, Arkansas. In 1954, the Civil Rights Movement gained momentum when the United States Supreme Court made segregation illegal in public schools in the case of Brown versus the Board of Education. In 1957, Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas asked for volunteers from all black high schools to attend the formerly segregated school. On September 3rd, 1957, nine black students known as the Little Rock Nine arrived at Central High School to begin classes, but were instead met by the Arkansas National Guard on the order of the governor, Orville Faubus, and a screaming, threatening mob. The Little Rock Nine tried again a couple of weeks later and made it inside, but had to be removed for their safety when violence ensued. Finally, President Dwight D. Eisenhower intervened and ordered federal troops to escort the Little Rock Nine to and from classes at Central High. Still, the students faced continual harassment and prejudice. Their efforts, however, brought much-needed attention to the issue of desegregation and fueled protests on both sides of the issue.
Thank you, brother. Now let's talk about the Civil Rights Act of 1957.
Yeah, I spoke about this, I think, like some interviews back, that there were all these civil rights acts, and I'm trying to figure out why did they need so many of the same, you know, civil rights acts, but apparently they must have meant different things. The Civil Rights Act of 1957, even though all Americans had gained the right to vote, many southern states made it difficult for black citizens. They often required prospective voters of color to take literacy tests that were confusing, misleading, and impossible to pass. Wanting to show a commitment to the civil rights movement and minimize racial tensions in the South, the Eisenhower administration pressured Congress to consider new civil rights legislation. On September 9, 1957, President Eisenhower signed the Civil Rights Act of 1957 into law, the first major civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. It allowed federal prosecution of anyone who tried to prevent someone from voting. It has also created a commission to investigate voter fraud. Now, I know to y'all that just sounds familiar right now.
Always, always, always switching up the game. Brother, tell us about the Woolworths lunch counter protests.
Well, a lot of different things, like I said, came out of Brown versus Board of Education. Now, the Woolworths lunch counter, despite making some gains, black Americans still experience blatant prejudice in their daily lives. On February 1st, 1960, four college students took a stance against segregation in Greensboro, North Carolina, when they refused to leave a Woolworths counter without being served. Over the next several days, hundreds of people joined their cause in what became known as the Greensboro sit-ins. After some were arrested and charged with trespassing, protesters launched a boycott of all segregated lunch counters until the owners caved and the original four students were finally served at the Woolworths lunch counter where they first stood their ground. The effects spearheaded peaceful sit-ins and demonstrations in dozens of cities and helped launch the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to encourage all students to get involved in the civil rights movement. It also caught the eye of young college graduate Stokely Carmichael, who joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the Freedom Summer of 1964 to register black voters in Mississippi. In 1966, Carmichael became the chairman of SNCC, giving his famous speech in which he originated the phrase, Black Power.
Black Power. Our college students stepped up their game, man, and Greensboro was the spot. So guess what? Start an NAAE chapter, EA chapter in your city. We need you. Young people, let's get out here and combine with our ancestors and see if we can start a chapter in your city. So what was the impact, the true impact of Brown versus the Board of Education, Brother George?
Well, Though the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus the Board of Education didn't achieve desegregation on its own, the ruling and the steadfast resistance to it across the South fueled the civil rights movement in the United States. In 1955, a year after Brown versus Board of Education, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the Montgomery bus, and it led to the Montgomery bus boycott, led by Dr. Martin Luther King, in a movement that would eventually lead to the toppling of Jim Crow laws across the South. It also led to the passage of the Civil Rights Movement of 1964. It led to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and it led to the Fair Housing Act of 1968. In 1976, the Supreme Court issued another landmark decision in Runyon versus Macquarie, ruling that even private non-secretarial schools that denied admission to students on the basis of race violated federal civil rights. So now they didn't got to the private schools and they couldn't do it either. By overturning the separate but equal doctrine, the court's decision in Brown versus the Board of Education has set the legal precedents that would be used to overturn laws enforcing segregation in all public facilities. But despite its undoubted impact, the historical verdict fell short of achieving its primary mission of integrating the nation's public schools. Because even today, you still have a lot of public schools that are still segregated, basically.
Hence, as I said earlier, simply separate. Let's give thanks to our ancestors who are with us and who have transitioned on, who had the courage to stand up to a system and say no. Rosa Parks, who decided that she didn't want to ride in the back, I say thank you. And all of those other ancestors for giving their lives blood, sweat, and tears so that it could be much, much easier for us. So I'll say now, Brother George, let's ride. Tell us about the Freedom Riders.
Yes, sir, I'll be glad to. On May 4th, 1961, 13 Freedom Riders, 7 black and 6 white activists, mounted a Greyhound bus in Washington, D.C., embarking on a bus tour of the American South to protest segregation bus terminals. They were testing the 1960 decision by the Supreme Court of Boynton versus Virginia that declared the segregation in interstate transportation facilities unconstitutional. Facing violence from both police officers and white protesters, the Freedom Riders drew international attention. On Mother's Day of 1961, the bus reached Anniston, Alabama, where a mob mounted the bus and threw a bomb onto it. The Freedom Riders escaped the burning bus, but were badly beaten. Photos of the bus engulfed in flames were widely circulated, and the group could not find a bus driver to take them further. U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, brother of President John F. Kennedy, negotiated with Alabama Governor John Patterson to find a suitable driver, and the Freedom Riders resumed their journey under police escort on May 20th. But the officers left the group once they reached Montgomery, where a white mob brutally attacked the bus. Attorney General Kennedy responded to the riders and called from Dr. Martin Luther King by sending federal marshals to Montgomery. On May 24, 1961, a group of Freedom Riders reached Jackson, Mississippi. Though met with hundreds of supporters, the group was arrested for trespassing in the whites-only facility and sentenced to 30 days in jail. Attorneys for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, brought the matter to the U.S. Supreme Court, who reversed the convictions. Hundreds of new Freedom Riders were drawn to the cause, and the riots continued. In the fall of 1961, under pressure from the Kennedy administration, the Interstate Commerce Commission issued regulations prohibiting segregation in interstate transit terminals.
Wow. You know, protests are a highly effective method for achieving change in this country. Keep marching, keep protesting, and keep riding. Let's talk about the March on Washington.
Well, the March on Washington, as all of us know, was probably the most memorable and significant thing that happened with, I don't want it to overshadow everything, but it was probably the most memorable thing that happened during the Civil Rights era. Arguably, one of the most famous events of the Civil Rights Movement took place on August 28, 1963, the March on Washington. It was organized and attended by civil rights leaders such as A. Philip Randolph, who we mentioned earlier on, Bayard Rustin, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. More than 200,000 people of all races congregated in Washington, D.C. for the peaceful march, with the main purpose of forcing civil rights legislation and establishing job equality for everyone. The highlight of the march was King's speech, in which he continually stated, "I have a dream." King's "I have a dream" speech quickly became a slogan for equality and freedom.
All right. Martin Luther King had a dream, and Marvin Roan has a vision, and that is a vision for peace in our community, politics, economics, athletics, health, wellness, fitness, and nutrition through the NAAEA and community collaborations. Go back and listen to parts 1 through 8 with Brother George. He's done a great job of chronicling our history. You need to know it, you need to learn it, and you need to teach it to your children. Let's move forward now. Let's go to the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Okay, so here we go with another Civil Rights Act. I think that this one probably would be the final. Now, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, legislation initiated by John Fitzgerald Kennedy before his assassination. So he had intended on doing it. And then when Johnson took his place in office, he went through with it. Into law on July 2nd of that year, of 1964, King and other civil rights activists witnessed the signing. The law guaranteed equal employment for all, limited the use of voter literacy tests, and allowed federal authorities to ensure public facilities were integrated.
Well, let's move right into the Voting Rights Act.
This was another act that was signed by Lyndon Johnson. When President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law August 6, 1965, he took the Civil Rights Act of 1964 several steps further. The new law banned all voter literacy tests and provided federal examinations in certain voting jurisdictions. It also allowed the Attorney General to contest state and local poll taxes. As a result, poll taxes were later declared unconstitutional in Harper versus Virginia State Board of Elections in 1966.
You are listening to NAAEA Community Conversations, Part 9 of What Slavery Did to Us. It's a conversation with Brother George talking about the Civil Rights era. We're moving down now to the Fair Housing Act. Give us the act, brother.
The Fair Housing Act. Like I said, when Brown versus the Board of Education happened, it just had a snowballing effect because it opened up doors for a lot of different arenas. Now, the Fair Housing Act. The Fair Housing Act became law on April 11, 1968, just days after King's assassination. It prevented housing discrimination based on race, sex, national origin, and religion. It was also the last legislation enacted during the Civil Rights era. The Civil Rights Movement was an empowering yet precautious time for Black Americans. The efforts of civil rights activists and countless protesters of all races brought about legislation to end segregation, Black voter suppression, and discriminatory employment and housing practices. In other words, the civil rights movement, you know, did a great deal of things, you know, for our people. And we should always, you know, appreciate the people that that participated during that time period, and some of whom, you know, gave their lives. You know, and another one of those I'm going to move into is Vernon Johns. Now, Vernon Johns was significant because Vernon Johns was an American minister and civil rights activist. Johns was best known as the predecessor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. In other words, he was the one that Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, basically followed, and he replaced him as the pastor when he retired his pastoralship. Now in Johns was the pastor of that church from 1948 to 1953. Johns was born in Darling Hearts, Prince Edward County in Virginia, to Willie Johns and Sally Branch Price Johns. Now, some of the things that were significant about Vernon Johns was Vernon Johns wasn't just another pastor that was in front of Dr. King. In 1948, Johns became the 19th pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. He was an early proponent of civil rights in Montgomery and a civil rights activist who urged his congregation to challenge the racial status quo. In response to the discrimination that African Americans faced on city buses, Johns once paid his fare and was directed to sit on the back of the bus, but refused to sit there and demanded his money back. This protest, according to some, helped set the stage for the December 1st, 1955 protest of Rosa Parks. Johns also helped African-American girls who had been raped by white men by demanding that local authorities arrest and persecute their attackers.
Vernon Johns, man, a bad man. Bad man. Beautiful brother. Go research your brother Johns. Let's talk about Mega Evers.
Now, Mega Evers was another significant person in the civil rights movement. Mega Evers, born in 1925 and was killed in 1963, was an African American civil rights activist who was murdered who was murdered due to drew national attention. Born in Mississippi, he served in World War II before going to work for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. After attempting to desegregate the University of Mississippi Law School in 1954, he became the NAACP field secretary in Mississippi. Evers was subject to threats as the most visible civil rights leader in the state, and he was shot to death in June of 1963. Although accused killer Byron De La Beckwith escaped conviction, the unearthing of new evidence decades later resulted in Beckwith's retrial and imprisonment. Now, I kind of think that was, I guess it was good that it happened, but I mean, if you kill a person in cold blood and then you get to live 30 more years of your life as a free man, and then they catch up with you when you're in, when you're an old man, and then put you in prison. I mean, who wouldn't take a sentence like that? You know, all your young life, you get to live normal, and then, they eventually caught him and put him in jail, and I don't even think it was that long ago. But he did end up getting sent to prison.
The courage that our ancestors had, not only in the civil rights era, but it goes back. And again, I encourage you to go back and listen to parts 1 through 8, men and women. Really, really great stuff when you sit down and just listen. All right, so let's move on now to one of our greats, Shirley Chisholm.
Man, Shirley Chisholm is a sister. That's a sister. Now, pioneering African-American politician Shirley Chisholm, from 1924 to 2005, began her professional career as a teacher. She served as the director of the Hamilton Madison Child Care Center until the late 1950s, then as an educator consultant for New York City's Bureau of Child Welfare. In 1968, Chisholm became the first African-American to earn election to Congress, where she worked on the Education and Labor Committee and helped form the Congressional Black Caucus. In 1972, she made history again by becoming the first black woman of a major party to run for a presidential nomination. After serving 7 terms in the House, Chisholm retired from office to become a teacher and public speaker. I mean, Shirley Chisholm, she was an amazing woman. She was the pride of our people back in the 70s. She was out there fighting. She was a lot like Congressman Waters, or Congresswoman Waters, Maxine Waters. I mean, they're like images, mirror images of each other. And I just love Shirley Chisholm.
I say who, including you, are willing to stand in the gap. And so we've heard these names of these icons who have stood in the gap for us. And now it's our turn. Go out and do something. Make a difference in the world. Let's talk about this man. He just left us. But let's talk about John Lewis.
John Lewis, John Lewis was one of the big 6 leaders of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. John Lewis continued to fight for people's rights since joining Congress in 1987. John Lewis grew up in an era of racial segregation. Inspired by Martin Luther King Jr., he joined the burgeoning civil rights movement. Lewis was a freedom rider, spoke at 1963 March on Washington, and led the demonstration that became known as Bloody Sunday. He was elected to Congress in 1986 and received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2011. During the civil rights struggle, Lewis was arrested approximately 40 times. Lewis was the youngest speaker at the March on Washington in 1963. In 1963, Lewis became chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The violent attacks were recorded. This is dealing with Bloody Sunday. The violent attacks were recorded and disseminated throughout the country, and the images proved too powerful to ignore. Bloody Sunday as a day was labeled, sped up the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And that's our brother, John Lewis. Rest in peace, brother.
Note, our ancestors had effective organizations that made change not only in their community, but in this country. Again, I challenge you to go out and make a difference in your community where you live. Brother George, give us Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
No, I won't. Not just yet. Now, if you notice, I haven't spoken about any of the nationalists or revolutionary leaders of the 1960s. And they were out there. But what I'm going to do, it was so much, and I know that our people are very much attached to the civil rights era because that probably was the most significant era in our history here in the Americas. And so what I did was I broke the civil rights era up into two categories, the nationalist and revolutionary organizations and the integrationist organizations. And because there was so much impact from the integrationalist organizations, I took one sitting to deal with them, and then in the next part, I'll deal with the nationalists and the revolutionary leaders. Now, I'm going to deal with probably the most significant person of the civil rights era, which was the most significant leader of the civil rights era was Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a social activist and Baptist minister who played a key role in the American civil rights movement from the middle 1950s until his assassination in 1968. King sought equality and human rights for African Americans, the economically disadvantaged, and all victims of injustice through peaceful protest. He was the driving force behind watershed events such as the Montgomery bus boycott and the 1963 March on Washington, which helped bring about such landmark legislation as the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964 and is remembered each year on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a U.S. federal holiday since 1968. God bless Martin Luther King, and God bless us all. And now, Brother Mark.
All right, all right. I encourage you to understand the importance of education. That's one of the tenets of the NAAEA, for knowledge is power. What role will you play in what I term the rumbling 20s? You know, back in the 1900s, it was the roaring 20s, but these days are the rumbling 20s. So, Brother George, thank you for joining us today for another segment of NAAEA Community Conversations. And we will now, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, I just I feel like that was a very significant part of our history, and to try to rush through it without talking about all of the events that took place during that time period, I felt as I thought through it would be a mistake, and so I felt like to cover all of those different events and many of the people, because I didn't cover all of the people that participated that were factors in the civil rights movement as integrationists. You know, I didn't cover all of them, but I covered as many as I could, and I thought that the events and the actual legislation that came out of what took place was much more important, because those men didn't feel like their names were important. They felt like the people were important. And that at that time, you know, we moved from a time period of segregation of white and black bathrooms and being dehumanized and different things to a position of dignity, you know, where you could walk dignified and you could protect yourself, you know, defend yourself. If someone was to attack you, you could defend yourself. And unlike, you know, during segregation where someone could attack you and get away with it, basically, you know. So I appreciate the time today, brother, you know, and I'm out.